Welcome to Working in the Quarry, a Masonic education podcast brought to you by the Grand Lodge of Nebraska's Education Committee. Here you'll find audio versions of educational materials regularly distributed to Masons throughout the Nebraska jurisdiction, in addition to original content. Disclaimer: any views expressed in this podcast are those of the content creators and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Grand Lodge of Nebraska, its officers or lodges, or of Freemasons in this or any other jurisdiction. Please also note that the rituals, lectures, and customs of Freemasonry differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Masons outside of Nebraska are encouraged to contact their education officers if they have any questions about the material presented here. Thank you. And now on to this episode. Nebraska ritual work, from whence did it come? The two biggest myths in Freemasonry are, 1, ritual never changes, and 2, the ritual used in my jurisdiction is the right, ancient, true, correct, only the original ritual. Nothing could be further from the truth. In general, the origins of ritual are very hard to trace. There have been many different versions since the organization of Grand Lodge Freemasonry in 1717 in England. And when that ritual was transplanted to the new country of the United States of America, things took an even wilder turn. As most Masons are aware, the ritual varies from state to state in the United States and also from country to country in the world. While we all agree on the big ideas that Masonry is teaching, there seems to be quite a difference of opinion regarding the actual words, movements, and other details that go into making Masonic ritual. While a general study of the genesis of ritual is certainly worthwhile, this presentation will instead focus on the history of the ritual used in Nebraska and how it came to be standardized. Ritual in the beginnings of Freemasonry was quite simple and varied considerably between lodges and countries, as overseeing organizations such as Grand Lodges had not yet been established. The first rituals seemed to consist purely of a catechism of sorts that was often shared with the candidate around the festive board table set up in the middle of the lodge room. As Masonry grew and became more of an intellectual pursuit, the rituals were expanded and became more like what we are used to today. However, prior to the formation of the first Grand Lodge of England in 1717, there was little similarity between rituals from different lodges. This became even more complicated when the Grand Lodge of England separated into the Ancients and the Moderns in 1751. This resulted in quite a bit of confusion, not only in America, but in England and Europe as well. The basic issue that caused the divide was one of determining the future of the craft as either a social club or a fraternal organization based on the operative lodges. The moderns wanted to modernize the ritual and put much less emphasis on it in the fraternity. The group that became known as the Ancients felt that the ritual was untouchable and that any changes from the ritual being practiced at that time would be straying from the landmarks of Freemasonry. These two opposing views resulted in the separation of the two groups. The moderns retained control of what was known as the Grand Lodge of England, and the Ancients established their own Grand Lodge, known as the Most Ancient and Honorable Society of Free and Accepted Masons, according to the old constitutions. Reader's note: these are not the only two Grand Lodges during the early days of Grand Lodge Masonry. For example, there was a Grand Lodge at York and a Grand Lodge at Liverpool. End reader's note. Around 1764, a lodge of Scottish Masons from Edinburgh in London transferred their affiliation from the Ancients to the Moderns' Grand Lodge. A member of that lodge, William Preston, was a well-known lecturer on Freemasonry and had been working for several years on collecting, sorting, and standardizing the various Masonic rituals extant in England, Scotland, and elsewhere at the time. He would meet with friends once or twice a week to try out his new lectures and ritual modifications, and this work resulted in the publication of Illustrations of Freemasonry in 1772. This book, the first printed material on Freemasonry other than exposés, was a collection of lectures and other information regarding the history and practice of Freemasonry. Preston's book was wildly popular, running to 12 editions in his lifetime. While Preston's illustrations was a step forward in standardizing Masonic ritual, it contained no esoteric material, which was still being transmitted mouth to ear, or was obtained by reading one of the many exposés that had been printed. The Grand Lodge of England, both ancient and modern, had recombined in 1813, and as part of the settlement had attempted to create a standardized ritual for all of its lodges. This effort stretched into 1816 with little success, other than to balance the lecture and ritual portions. Diversity in ritual work continues to this day, with as many as 100 different rituals being used in England, in addition to the recommended standard ritual published by the United Grand Lodge of England. Ritual work in America. Freemasonry followed men from other nations to North America and took a hold in our nascent country as it had across England and the European continent. However, the spread of Freemasonry was complicated by several factors. 1. Who issued the charter? Depending on if the Grand Lodge of England, ancient or modern, the Grand Lodge of Ireland, or the Grand Lodge of Scotland issued the charter, the ritual used in your lodge might vary greatly. 2. The rapid expansion of the United States into the interior of the country meant that many grand jurisdictions were chartering lodges at a fantastic pace to keep up with the growth of the country. Overproduction of lodges and masons led to poor quality work that was seldom managed. 3. Due to the immense size of the United States, it was nearly impossible in that time period for a Grand Lodge to afford to send out custodians to monitor the quality of the work. Even if the Grand Lodges had had the money, the difficulty and slow pace of travel would have still rendered it nearly impossible. 4. As many Masons were on the move settling new territory and wanting to enjoy the advantages of Masonry in their new cities, a new lodge might consist of Masons made in a variety of different lodges from the East and under a variety of ritual schemes. What ritual to use was an important question, and absent any real guidance from the Grand Jurisdiction, each lodge would settle on a ritual or combination of rituals that seemed to work for them. 5. There was much work and discussion done on whether to have a national Grand Lodge, such as in England, with an overall Grand Master. Reader's note: George Washington was proposed as the first Grand Master of the United States. He declined. End reader's note. Or should each state and or territory be sovereign? These factors led to confusion in the craft. As men traveled about and wanted to visit a lodge, it was often not possible to determine if he was a true and lawful brother or just someone who was trying to take advantage of the support Masons give to one another. The issue of recognition between jurisdictions also became contentious, based on where their original charters came from and what kind of work they were doing. Moreover, some states and territories had lodges that had been chartered from several different states, and again, the question of ritual became a point of argument when setting up a new grand jurisdiction. Reader's note: Nebraska was one of these situations, where the Grand Lodge was actually chartered from three different other Grand Lodges. End reader's note. Early attempts at consistency. By the late 1700s to early 1800s, this issue had gotten to the point that Masonry in general in the U.S. began discussion on the idea of settling on a set ritual and set of lectures. In 1797, Thomas Smith Webb had published a Masonic book, Freemasons' Monitor or Illustrations of Masonry, which contained what Webb claimed was the original and true work as published by Preston. While it was very popular, it was not the only monitor for Masons published at this time. The work published by Webb is considered to be an abridgment, revision, and rearrangement of the actual Preston lectures. It is thought that Webb received the Preston lectures from an English brother named John Hammer, who had received the lectures from Preston in the Lodge of Antiquity and had paperwork to confirm his qualifications. Webb was so impressed by the Preston material that he later obtained a copy of Preston's illustrations when it became available in America. Webb felt this sort of guide would be indispensable to American Masons, but that the Preston work was too cumbersome to be easily adopted by American lodges. Although Webb's first edition of his monitor very closely followed Preston's work, with each edition, Webb and his group revised, added, or otherwise adapted the Preston work to what he thought would be more effective in American lodges and to add concepts from other Masonic ritual work that was available to him for study. For example, Webb is probably the author of the second section prayer in the Master Mason degree. He also wrote the detailed lecture of the working tools for the Master Mason degree based on other existing non-Preston work. He also removed all reference to the monarchy. This revision or alteration of work was not always well received, and there was considerable argument in the Masonic world about the Webb work and its authenticity of being Preston's work. Webb's work did go on to be the most popular in the U.S., and he trained several roving lecturers to spread the work about the country in the hopes of creating a unified work for Masonry. In the early 19th century, there was again a renewed call to create a national Grand Lodge. Despite the less than successful outcome in England to standardize the ritual, in the U.S. it had become a hot topic among Masons. No one seemed to be on the fence about the idea. They were either strongly for it or strongly against it. It seems the revolutionary spirit was still alive in Masons. The main drivers for this idea of a national standard ritual in the U.S. stemmed from the recent anti-Masonic fever over the Morgan Affair and a political party that sought to mitigate the influence of Freemasonry in America. These influences had caused a near destruction of the craft in the U.S., with many men abandoning the craft and Grand Lodges barely surviving in many states and territories. A serious endeavor to create a standardized ritual for all grand jurisdictions to use was attempted in 1842-1843 in Baltimore, Maryland. Representatives from Connecticut, Virginia, Rhode Island, Maryland, New York, South Carolina, District of Columbia, Massachusetts, Alabama, and New Hampshire attended. The purpose of the Baltimore Convention was stated to be to bring together all the jurisdictions in the U.S. for the purpose of standardizing the work and other issues of recognition and consistency. The convention elected noted Masonic lecturer John Dove of Virginia as president. Dove was a student of Jeremy Cross, who was a direct student of Webb. He opened the conference with a direct mission for the attendees. Quote, "Brethren, for the first time in the history of the United States of North America, the craft have found it necessary and expedient to assemble by their representatives to take into consideration the propriety of devising some uniform mode of action by which the ancient landmarks of our beloved order may be preserved and perpetuated." End quote. Thus, the aim of the convention was twofold. 1. Produce a uniformity of Masonic work in North America and have it adopted by all American Grand Lodges. 2. Recommend any other administrative matters that would promote Masonry worldwide. These outcomes were to be published in the Masonic Trestle Board or Manual for Use by the craft throughout North America. Committees were formed to work out the standard lectures and esoteric work, which was then performed for the conference in an attempt to get agreement with the newly created work. This did not go smoothly, and the issue of sovereignty of the Grand Lodge of each state was so important that it overshadowed many of the ideas being presented for a unified work. Ultimately, the conference was a total disaster. When a consensus was finally reached and the process of printing the outcome began, politics, egos, and other less savory traits of humanity came into full bloom, and the printed trestle board was disavowed by many participants in the conference, including Dove. In 1846, another attempt at a unifying conference was held, but with only 6 Grand Lodges present, it was felt that they could have no lasting effect on American Masonry. The result of all this discord was to encourage other Masonic ritualists and writers to publish their own version of Masonic workings. A few of the smaller details that were discussed and proposed did get adopted by some of the jurisdictions, but the desired unity of work was unfulfilled. Rob Morris and the Masonic Conservators. Despite the failure of the Baltimore Convention of 1843 to solve any of Masonry's problems with work, the idea of a need for consistent work was still high on most Masons' lists. Enter Rob Morris and the Masonic Conservators. Most Masons know of Brother Rob Morris as the United States Masonic Poet Laureate, or as the creator of the Order of the Eastern Star, but he was much more than that. Brother Morris was an author, editor, and publisher of many Masonic books. In addition, he started a national school of Masonic instruction. He is said to have visited nearly 2,000 lodges and conferred more than 50,000 Master Mason degrees. In June of 1860, Brother Morris decided the time was ripe for him to create an organization he called the Masonic Conservators, and attempt from a grassroots level to achieve a consistent work and influence the grand jurisdictions to adopt the work as Morris had it. Morris started by sending invitations to a select group of eminent Masons to join what he called an association of experienced and devoted Masons. The plan was to appoint one conservator in each lodge, who could then appoint two deputies. There would then be an area and national hierarchy, all of which would report to the head conservator, Rob Morris. Each conservator or deputy was to keep the work that Morris was teaching secret. The aim of this group was the dissemination of what Morris called the genuine work and lectures of the first three degrees as arranged by Preston and taught by Webb. Morris thought that through this organization, any changes or discrepancies in the Webb work that had occurred since Webb's death could be corrected and a consistent ritual could be achieved. To aid his conservators in doing the work as he had it, he created a very complex cipher book to track the secret work and proposed that a system of schools of instruction be held in lodges by Masonic lecturers trained in his system, and that the conservators would work to achieve acceptance of the Morris system as the standard ritual in their jurisdiction. As might be imagined, many grand jurisdictions did not take kindly to Brother Morris creating a secret organization for the purpose of influencing the work of a Grand Lodge. They saw his work as a direct challenge to the sovereignty and power of the Grand Master and the Grand Lodge. There was also the issue of money, as Morris charged for his materials and for membership. There was also the constant problem of Morris not being able to prove where he had gotten the work he was promoting. Morris claimed to be using the purest form of web work that he had received in Vermont from a brother Samuel Wilson, but Wilson and others that were trained either by Webb or one of his students denied that Morris had the correct work. This information spread rapidly in the Masonic world, and many Grand Lodges enacted Morris and the conservators out of business. During the last 3 years of the organization, Morris spent the majority of his time fighting the accusations. And so, by 1865, the conservator movement was over. Work was still inconsistent between the states and territories, and nothing had really been solved on the issue of consistent ritual across the U.S. Nebraska. So where was Nebraska in all this controversy? Nebraska had lodges chartered from several different grand jurisdictions to the east, not all of which adopted the Morris version of the Preston work. The Grand Lodge of Nebraska was then chartered in 1857 from three different grand jurisdictions, Illinois, Iowa, and Missouri. In fact, Missouri used the Barney or Baltimore work and expended considerable effort to discredit Morris and his work. In Nebraska, being of grand dimensions, the issue of managing the lodges and keeping the work pure was a much bigger problem than even the smaller eastern states had. It was a well-known issue that the DGCs were not visiting their lodges and that work in the state was poor and inconsistent at best. Moreover, the first Grand Master was raised in Ohio and therefore would have been most conversant with Ohio work of the time. During Worshipful Brother Jordan's first term as Grand Master of the newly chartered Grand Lodge of Nebraska, Worshipful Brother Jordan, in his address, pointed out specifically the non-uniformity for work and the desire to adopt some form of the work for all lodges in Nebraska that was in keeping with the generally accepted work being used in the majority of the rest of the country at that time. It is recorded that Worshipful Brother Jordan exemplified the work that should be adopted by Nebraska and recommended adopting Cornelius Moore's Craftsman as the standard work. The Grand Lecturer was charged with disseminating this work out to the lodges in Nebraska as soon as possible to assure adoption of this work. This is the last mention in any documentation of the Moore work, and it is likely that due to a variety of challenges and the new conservator movement that the work was never truly adopted by Nebraska lodges. As Masonry moved forward in Nebraska from 1858, there were numerous attempts to adopt a standardized work, including an attempt to adopt the recommendations of the Baltimore Conference of 1843, which also floundered. By 1863, it was agreed that the Webb-Preston work should be what the Grand Lodge should adopt as the standard ritual. But whose version of the Webb-Preston work should be adopted? The work used by Vermont and other New England states that had access to direct students of Webb, or the version of work being promoted by Morris and the conservator movement. Several prominent Nebraska Masons, along with several Grand Lodge officers, had joined the conservator movement and had even attended the National School of Instruction given by Brother Morris in 1860 and were pushing for the wholesale adoption of the Morris work. List of Nebraska Conservators: Brownsville, Robert Furness; Nebraska City, S. G. Redfield; Lee P. Gillette; Henry P. D. Brown; William E. Hill; Omati, G. W. Wilkinson; J. H. Halleck; Omaha City, George Armstrong; Plattsmouth, D. H. Wheeler; E. T. Duke; John Marshall. In keeping with Grand Masonic tradition, the Grand Lodge of Nebraska set up a committee to study the work being done in Nebraska and in other states to make a recommendation of which work should be adopted as the standard work of Nebraska. As could be expected, there were disagreements about the legitimacy of the Morris work versus the Webb Preston work, and the Nebraska members of the conservators worked hard to convince the craft that the Morris work was pure and loyal to the actual Webb Preston work. In fact, the committee assured the Grand Lodge that the Morris work was, quote, substantially the same as the Preston, end quote. With this assurance on their part over disagreements, Nebraska adopted the Webb Preston work as influenced by the Morris work in 1874. Although it was recognized that the work adopted was most likely a blend of the true Webb Preston work and the Morris work, it was considered to be uniform enough with other jurisdictions, and the 18-year quest for a standard ritual was finally at an end. Conclusions. The quest for the original and true work has been going on since the beginning of Masonry. The work was sufficiently complex that Preston spent considerable time collecting and documenting the rituals used in England and Scotland in an attempt to find some common ground. His work resulted in a popular set of lectures, but even those changed over the years. Masonry's transplantation to America brought even more change to the ritual through rapid expansion of lodges, poor or non-existent quality control of the ritual, and various attempts to create a standard version of existing work. But what about Nebraska? From whence did our work come? Tracing the path of Nebraska work results in a picture like this. 1. Preston created a popular set of lectures and ritual in England. 2. The Preston work was then modified, shortened, and rearranged by Webb in the U.S. 3. There were a number of other non-Preston works available in the U.S. that were in use in different jurisdictions and likely spread west with the expansion of the country. 4. Rob Morris created his own version of the Preston Webb work and attempted to get it adopted by all jurisdictions through the conservator organization. 5. After several tries, Nebraska ended up adopting a version of work that was allegedly the true Preston Webb, but admitted that some of the work was mixed with the Morris work. 6. Changes have been made to the lectures and the rituals since the final adoption in 1874 to the present day. So we are doing some form of Preston's work as interpreted by Webb, as modified by Morris, with changes as adopted since 1874. The final question is this: does it make any difference where our work came from or who the author was? The best answer to that question comes from Brother Mackey in his Encyclopedia. In part, it says, quote, "While the ceremonies or ritual have varied at different periods and still vary in different countries, the science and philosophy, the symbolism and the religion of Freemasonry continue and will continue to be the same wherever true Masonry is practiced." We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Working in the Quarry, an educational podcast brought to you from the Education Committee of the Grand Lodge of Nebraska. We'd like to thank our podcast content creators and readers. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please send them to educationchairman@nebraskagrandlodge.com. Thank you for listening.